Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and Caroline's not joining us today, but check in next week. She'll be back with us. I have a very wonderful book to share with you today. The Mountains of Paris, How Awe and Wonder Rewrote My Life. And the author is David Oates. He's the author of 5 books of nonfiction, including Paradise Wild, Reimagining American Nature. His recent work has won multiple nonfiction awards as well as pushcart nominations. His nonfiction has appeared in Georgia Review, Creative Nonfiction, Orion, and elsewhere, and his prose and poetry are featured in an ongoing exchange with the German literary journal Wortschau. Obviously, our guest today is a well-rounded writer. Welcome to Writer's Voices, David.
Thank you, Monica. It's really fun to be here, and thank you for using the word wonderful in your intro, since that word wonder is fairly central to this book.
It is. Your publicist kind of pitched this book to me as a book on transformational travel, but I'm not sure that really does it justice.
It's the funniest thing, trying to put a book into a category.
Yes.
You know, the book-selling world is all about what niche can we slot you into, and they want to chain you there forever. The Mountains of Paris is a real sort of mongrel hodgepodge of a lot of different kinds of writing, and it certainly includes a lot of travel. The location where the book is sort of inspired is Paris, you know, the world's greatest city. Arguably.
Right, yep. City of Light.
I had a chance to spend 4 months there on a residency. What an unbelievable lucky break. And there I was in the middle of this gigantic hodgepodge of amazing art and stunning architecture and staggeringly available good music and the deep past and history and blood on the cobblestones and modern art everywhere and fashion in the windows, which was of all of it the strangest to me, but that's another story. So there I was in the middle of this unbelievable opportunity, and I just started to think about how you get touched in your sort of your deepest self unexpectedly by a passage of music, let's say, or by a little glimpse of the past, and you feel that just brief but very deep, strange, out of time experience, which I'm convinced everybody feels them. Everybody has those moments, and they really do escape language. They're so big and so rich and so important, and yet when you try to put them into words, the words are always too little for the event. And so I just kind of took that as an interesting challenge, both just for thinking and also a good writing challenge. How do you talk about that which is too big to talk about? And that is that moment of awe and wonder.
Right. And you talk about it as the sublime.
It's one of
the words that you use. Now, I'm sitting here in Fairfield, Iowa, which is the home of Maharishi International University and the center of the Transcendental Meditation Movement in the United States. So here we would tend to refer to this as transcendence.
Yeah, and that's a good old word in American literature too, and it's an honorable word. You would associate Emerson and Thoreau and those folks with it. And
right.
I think that big moment, whether it's with music or art or out in nature, under that big, big night sky, you know, when you happen to have a starry sky. I live in Portland, and so we have cloudy skies most of the winter. And when it clears, we're just staggered by, oh, look. And if you happen to have a quiet moment and you look up and you just let your mind go up, whoa, you're thinking, what is that? I think that experience is the origin of all religions.
The issues that you faced growing up in a religious home,
yes,
are an important aspect of this book, and one that that actually drew me in. It's something that you start right up front with.
I did.
Yeah.
I thought, well, this has been so central to my path. I don't want to say my struggle, but it felt like a struggle at the time. And it has led me to sort of think about, well, what was underneath all of that talk about salvation and this verse and that verse? And what was under it was what saved me. And that was just the allowing myself to feel connected to the larger world and to say, you know, this is unbelievably beautiful. It's immeasurably mysterious. No one ever gets to the bottom of it. And here we are, just in the moment. And
right.
Being able to go to that moment was so, I guess I'll use the word transformative. It at least was the starting end of transformation that let me go past the pattern of self-condemnation and self-loathing that I had been kind of trapped into.
And it does seem like, to me, religions tend to get trapped in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everybody wants to own it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is unownable. And I think this is the grown-up me, not the reactive 19-year-old who was still, you know, fighting tooth and nail to get out of it. But with time and reflection and the healing of some wounds, I've noticed that literally every religious tradition I'm aware of has a thread within it of people who will say what you and I are saying, who
right.
say, don't fret about the finger that's pointing at the moon, to use the old, it's kind of a cliche, but it's a good one. You know, if someone's pointing at the moon, don't look at the finger.
Mm.
Look at the moon. And you will find people in Islam, the Sufi tradition. You'll find it in Christianity for sure, in a variety of meditative and contemplative traditions. And you'll find it in Judaism and, you know, right, and including a bunch of ones that I don't know about, where they say it's really about what it's about, not about the words we use about it. And so stop obsessing about the words and categories and doctrines and start paying attention to that reality which is bigger and grander and more beautiful than we can express. And just put your heart on that and you will be in the right spot. So it's a big move for me to be able to say even Baptists
right.
get to this. And I, if there are any listening, forgive me for spoofing you, but my account is a true one, according to my experience, that Baptists get there too, to that large and inclusive place.
Mm. You know, I grew up Catholic, and my mother who's usually with us, is still very, very much strongly Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic, but the thing that I appreciate most about the Catholic tradition is the ritual. I feel like ritual can be used to take you to that place. And particularly in a beautiful cathedral.
That which became the anchor point of my 4 months in Paris. I found a cathedral that's a little bit off the tourist track, but huge. It's a huge old Gothic pile called Saint Eustache. And it's right in the center of town. It's not as beautiful as some, and it's certainly not as famous as Notre Dame. But there I was, and I heard the organ play there. And I've been chasing organ music my whole life since I was a mid-teen. For what reason, it's not clear to me. It's big music, and it's beautiful, and it's complex, and it seems to challenge you. And I walked into this gigantic cathedral, and here were these sounds emanating from the back and echoing from the front and crossing over with each other. And just, it was a Bach fugue, you know, which is this layered polyphonic music that's very complex, but that has, it keeps resolving into these moments of great, great consonance. And boy, that music just fills your mind just like a night sky.
Mm.
And so that organ, one of the best in Europe, I'm quite sure, was sort of the candle to my moth. And I made my way across town by foot, usually twice a week, to hear whatever was going to be played on that big thing. And just to enter this space dedicated to a faith I no longer followed, but which was beautiful and 500 years old and sort of had the well-worn human spirit in it somehow. And I would just sit there and listen and feel myself expand.
I find that with some religious music too, even like the Gregorian chants.
Boy, does that ever work.
Yeah.
And if you get to hear some in a big church like that, then suddenly you understand what that music is about, because it really is about the space, the large volume of echoing space that it typically would not only be sung in, but was, I think, composed for the purpose of being sung in. And that evocation of space, again, puts you into a spooky mind. It's not only the music, it's also the sort of the sonic mapping of this space, which is as big as a cavern. And if you think about that, it's sort of a specialized cave that we go into to change our minds briefly for a bigger mind that is a shared mind.
Mm-hmm.
If it's chanting going on, and then if you look around and you think about all the hands and all the minds and all the lives that created this space hundreds of years ago, and you could say, for me,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Here I am.
Right.
I'm the recipient of artistry and intellect and engineering and passion and sound and performance. I'm the recipient of all these things that I didn't do. I'm just here receiving them. You know, even for an individualistic American full
yes.
of, you know, me, even for that kind of person, you could get cracked out of your hard-shelled little individualistic mind, and you can enter a shared space, which I think is really wholesome to get to every once in a while.
And, you know, our culture tends to not value art, music, architecture sometimes. Some of these things, you know, it's considered a... There are certain segments of our population, a frill, certain segments who think, oh, we shouldn't be wasting tax dollars on things like that. But what is it that survives past civilizations? What is it that we remember from 300, 500, 1,000, 10,000 years ago? It's art, literature, music, and architecture.
Yeah, that's a wonderful paradox, isn't it?
Yes.
That which is considered not as important as, you know,
industry
and money making. Those are the things that are important. And power, you know, the exercise, the getting and the exercising of power. Power and money, okay, that's what rules the world. But there's this strange underworld of things that are actually more important and more lasting. And they include loving kindness. And they include beauty, and they include connectedness with each other. So we live in this really odd, paradoxical world where money and power govern everything outwardly. And if you think about it and experience it a little bit, you begin to see that the yeah, but. You say, well, yeah, but what really matters is not those things. And if you take the historical perspective that you just took, Monica, then it becomes really vividly obvious what we care about from 15th century Florence is not who had the upper hand and who got to be boss this year. That is completely unimportant to us, except as it helps us understand who made the art and
right.
how the cathedral got built
right.
and who wrote the music. So we remember Palestrina and Monteverdi, and we don't know the name of a single doge from Venice. Not a single one. At least us non-historians.
Exactly. Money and power don't last. But
they don't.
Art, music, culture do. Beauty lasts.
So if you're a writer or a poet or a musician, you live in this double economy, that the outward, the world's economy of exchange is money and power, and then the artist's economy is a gift economy where you make things in order to give them away. And as you do so, you enrich your own humanity and you augment and bolster the humanity of those who are around you. And there's this other reality of exchange and living that we're all simultaneously living in. And I think the fun of being a writer or an artist or doing the work you do, getting to bring it out into conversation and sort of daylight these things with other writers, is that we get to be reminded of what our roots go down into, and not to get too pulled away from that grounding with worry and fret over who's in charge this month.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, I've been doing the show now since 2006 with my mother. Mm. And sometimes I think, why am I still doing this? Because I make negative.
Congratulations. Welcome to the writer's world.
Because I pay someone to help with my website, and I pay my friend Crystal does a lot of work on the website and creates the YouTubes and so forth, and I pay her for all of that. And I don't earn anything from it. However, I make a lot of money in my day job, which is in industry. I'm an entrepreneur. And so I think, well, why am I still spending all this time doing this? But you just nailed it.
Mm. Yeah, it's a privilege. My day job was teaching, and a lot of artists also follow that course, mm-hmm. because it's a very, very small percentage of writers are making a living at it, and an even smaller percentage of artists.
Right.
So you get a day job, you smile, you sort of spoof yourself a little bit. I guess I'm not famous yet. And in a way, it keeps the writing clean. It says, well, I'm not worrying about what the agent says will sell this week. I'm worrying about how to tell the truth the most beautifully as I can. Which was an ugly sentence, by the way.
But you made your point. Which is what it's all about, communication.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is David Oates, author of The Mountains of Paris, How Awe and Wonder Rewrote My Life. Now, this 4 months that you got to spend in Paris, it wasn't even your own residency, so you really were free to do what you wanted, right?
I was on nobody's radar. my partner's an artist. And he got this residency, and they're allowed to bring a companion, an accompagnateur, as they say in French. And we lived in his studio space, his atelier. It's in a big five-story building as long as a block, and it's full of artists and writers from all over the world. And in the corner of this sort of roomy, sort of living room plus dining room-sized space, picture that with a slightly high ceiling, in the corner were two cots and a hot plate.
we were living the bohemian artist life.
It was, and they were crowded over into this little cubby so that you couldn't even put them together. They were at right angles, and so I would reach up and hold his foot at night if I got a little lonely. And then we learned how to cook on that hot plate, and went to the markets and brought back whatever could be managed. Food in Paris is not cheap, so you need to figure out how to make your way. But there we were in this four-month residency. We went from January through the middle of April. And what a privilege. It was located right sort of catty-corner from the mayor's building and the Marais district. A lot of your listeners will have visited the Marais district. It's sort of the formerly bohemian, once upon a time gay district of Paris. Has great falafel shop in there that everybody wants to go to. So we were, and it's right downtown, walking distance from all the big things, and of course the Paris metro subway system runs right through there. So there we were, me with my bad French, just ready to give it a shot, and boy, do you feel free, just like the Joni Mitchell song, you know, I was a free man in Paris, I felt unfettered and alive. And boy, I did. And it was kind of an opening that said, write about something big, write about something worthy. Don't just tell us how to go find falafels.
So
see if you can tell us how to go find something.
Did you write all of this while you were there?
Lord, no.
Okay.
No. I took copious notes, and I didn't know I was working on it until right near the end of the stay. I was writing every day. Of course, I always do that. But I started to kind of, sometimes you're the witness of your own work process. You don't necessarily steer it. You just follow it. And I started looking at what I was trying to write about and how it added up. And it kind of hit me like a brick. I thought, well, this is about all of those moments of awe and wonder that you've been experiencing in front of not only the music at St. Eustache, but music other places and the architecture and trips to the museums there, the Louvre or the Musée d'Orsay, a moment with a Vermeer painting can fill up your whole mind for a whole week if you let it. And I'm kind of late to the visual arts. It's not my native tongue, language is. But having spent 20-plus years with my artist partner, we've had a lot of chances to go to galleries and museums, and for me to sort of struggle inarticulately with, well, what is it about this painting that I love? Or sometimes, why does this painting bug me so much? And he would just smile and let me flail. And at length, I started to get really comfortable writing about what I was experiencing with certain paintings. And so there are some painting experiences in this book, along with the music and art and architecture
and nature.
And nature, which is at least half the book, and it has been at least half of my life too. And it's been so much fun to recognize those two realms as being kind of overlays that the world of art somehow is able to trigger those same feelings of awe and wonder and depth and connectedness. The same feelings as I had been having for decades out in the big mountains where I kind of made my second home. I clambered around the Sierra Nevadas and the Cascades and a little bit in the Rockies habitually and obsessively and quite often all by myself, just to have that experience, to get 3 days deep and 10 or 12,000 feet high and have that quiet moment and say, okay, here we are.
And that's the title of your book, The Mountains of Paris, because Paris doesn't really have mountains.
It really doesn't. That's what you call a counterfactual. And it's a little bit of fun. Of course, there is a chapter about the one meager little hill that Paris does have.
Montmartre.
Called
Montmartre.
Yeah.
And you're not a fan of Sacré-Cœur.
Yeah, I'm a little bit hard on Sacré-Cœur.
Which I loved when I was there.
I love it too. I have history there. I was there when I was 20 and still real pretty bruised up, but still I could sit in Sacré-Cœur and listen to the mass in Latin, which I didn't speak, and alternately in French, which I didn't speak at the time. And so none of the language of dogma could hurt me is how I formulated it to myself. And instead I sat there and I got a little teary. My heart was pretty bruised up at that stage of my life, but I felt the healing of just the big space and the intentionality of whatever these guys up in front in the long dresses were doing. It was supposed to be directing you towards something bigger.
Yeah.
And I was able to credit that.
About the Catholic Mass, which I don't like it enough to go every week, but what I do like about it is the idea to me that the same words have been spoken through millennia. Mm-hmm. And with the same intent, and that carries some meaning.
It does. You know, sometimes it's important to remember to give people credit for their intentions.
Yeah.
And I really like your introducing that word because, yeah, okay, you got this dogma or that one, and you exclude these people and those people, and you did this bad thing in history. Okay, all of that's true, but still, there's an intentionality underneath it, all of those mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I guess as an error-prone human being, I would like to be judged more on my intentions than on my goof-up. So I should extend that to others. And when I remember to, then I do.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're talking today with David Oates, author of The Mountains of Paris, How Awe and Wonder Rewrote My Life. Before we get any further, and why don't you read a little bit from the book, David?
That would be so much fun. The prologue to the book is pretty short, and I think it's as good a way to get us right in the thick of it as any.
Awesome.
It's called The Night Walk. It's called The Night Walk. By the time I reached the cemetery on its bluff south of town, the fog had disappeared, and the beginnings of sunrise were lighting up the horizon. I had spent all night walking, praying, and crying. This was October in Santa Barbara, and the Santa Ana winds had raised night mists, but left us warm, electric, and on edge. Walking and praying all night. At some point, desperate for God's love, I had tried bashing my fists into a chain-link fence. Raising blood, that was good. But I noted from a corner of the mind where I watched myself judgingly, I noticed that I'd stopped at one good bloody knuckle. Yet the desperation was real. I was one of the uncountable gay kids trapped in evangelical Christianity, trapped by my own stubbornness and not quitting, and trapped again by fear of rejection by my family and friends, and above all, trapped by fear of the degeneracy that was so confidently predicted by these people for men or boys such as me. I was just 20. I saw the Pacific moving gray and silver all the way to its rim. At my feet was a long drop-off, rocks foaming in the surf. But despite my night-long untethering, I felt no weepy urge towards self-extinction, no thought of making an end. No, there was just the seething and the power and the beauty. I was standing in a grassy place with oaks and pines, and I reached out to touch the rough, moist bark of the nearest tree. I laid my forehead there, catching the faint pine scent. I felt something rushing and rushing, something bigger and truer than all this wailing and gnashing of teeth. And I raised my eyes to look again. Glow of pink and gold just beginning, bright planets still visible in the blue-violet sky, rightness and beauty all around me, silent, beyond doctrine, greater than thought, and somehow welcoming in their indifference. I had no idea how to process what was happening. Soon enough anyway, I trudged back to campus. I cleaned my face and squared my shoulders. I had a class in theology to prepare for. I was at a fly-speck Christian college, chosen for its earnestness. And then I would have a survey of English Lit, and there was something to read from the great big Norton Anthology, Volume 1. I wanted to get it done, and I wanted to have something to say for myself. But I kept that morning in my heart, that glow, that rightness. Yes, I also had a lifetime of God's alleged hate stored up in me, the unspoken contempt of family and church. I had been collecting these, silently watching and listening, as people minced and mocked and joked, as people preached and misapplied Bible verses. Of course, they had no idea about me. I knew how to pass. And they had meant well. I knew that. They had meant to safeguard the flock, to keep the children safe from the twisted ways of the world. And I was cosseted, no doubt about it, a middle-class kid from an uneventful corner of Los Angeles, dressed up for church, asked and warned and invited to follow the path of righteousness. And that's what I wanted. I wanted it fiercely. I memorized, I prayed. I hid myself behind a barricade of vigilance and pretending. But it was hopeless. I was headed for misery, loneliness, perdition. Everyone in my world said so. and our pious college life wasn't changing anything. Yet the morning world that I saw, that seethe of beauty, that extent that went so much further than anything words could capture, I held that in my heart. It helped me see how small my story was, how small and unremarkable. And for a second or a minute, it healed me, silent on a cliff in California. And that's where the prologue stops, that initial story, and then has a couple paragraphs about the book as a whole. Shall I go on?
Yes, please.
Okay. This big world, this immeasurable, wonderful, terrifying cosmos that we lose ourselves in and find ourselves in, this is the subject of this book. The twilight, all in fire and color, the night sky, limitless, incomprehensible. Even the strangeness of the living world and of each other. What is it? What is that tremendousness that breaks our heart with beauty and with longing and with fear and delight mixed so weirdly together, and that sometimes unexpectedly finds its echoes in the human arts, in music especially, or a painted canvas, or some other handmade thing that again brings that note of endlessness and power and beauty. In the gradually blooming years that followed my sad night's journey, I strove unconsciously but continuously toward that undegenerate life that I yearned for. It was a long time before I could handle other people, let alone the terrifying question of love. So I headed for the mountains, at first with others, climbing and backpacking, but soon solo for years and years. Years of stars rising over alpine basins and the clear, glowing granite of the High Sierras, years of riversides cloaked with welcoming pines, and peaks walked or scrambled or climbed until the whole world unfurled before me, all of it indifferent, beautiful, and right. Slowly I believed it, that I might be right, too. Small? Yes. Lonely? Yes. But right enough. The story I told myself at first was the usual story. Woe is me, suffering and hurt, and damn those narrow bigots. But all that dropped away in the mountains. Little by little, the quieter, larger self grew. The wideness of the world was my tutor. It was beauty. It was scale. It was depth and complexity. All I had to do was keep silent and pay attention and absorb. Made small, I grew. So when I got to Paris, many decades later, I was finally ready to see it, that bigger story, that story deeper than my heart, wide as the sky. And I think that anyone could re-envision his or her story in exactly this way. All it takes is remembering and admitting, yes, it was beautiful too. Savage, painful, but beautiful. I was in Paris for a winter and the beginnings of the spring. And there I discovered a present so vivid, so full of art and music and people and life, that I began to rewrite my past. This book is the record of that discovery, a present life awakened, an old life coming back in newness, revised and re-seen, and full of an unexpected grace. And leading to this final affirmation, or maybe it's just a hypothesis. Here it is. Stupendous beauty and power surround us and are us. Whosoever will become open to them will be changed.
And that was David Oates reading from the prologue of The Mountains of Paris, How Awe and Wonder Rewrote My Life. And in that last phrase, it just reminded me of a book I listened to recently, a book on tape by Octavia Butler, called, there were two books in this series. One was Talents, and I can't remember what the first one was, but in the whole kind of underlying hypothesis there, there was a woman, it's a dystopian futuristic novel, but she starts this new religion basically saying God is change. And you change God and God changes you.
That's a pretty brisk space, isn't it?
Yeah.
Change being so hard. Oh gosh, you know, as we confront global warming, there is such fear and anxiety in so many of us because we don't know what the world for our children is going to be like. And embracing change is, of course, a main task of anybody who's trying to grow their spirit. But when it's change on this scale, it is so hard to figure out how to come to terms with it. And in my view, it has to include some activism to try to do the right thing. But, you know, it's a thing of such scale that you feel dwarfed, and your sense of agency is so wounded. I don't know where I'm going with this, but the word change seems to have set me off.
And yeah. Well,
a book about nature and the sublime has to acknowledge this condition that we are in and say, well, we need to apply our noble thoughts and our deep hearts to this immediate question also.
Absolutely. And this Octavia Butler series, I just looked it up, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. And she wrote it in the 1990s, and it's like predicting climate change, and it's set in the 2030s to 50s, I think. And all the things that we're seeing now, she predicted in this book. Even Make America Great Again.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And a figure very similar to the person who is proposing
currently in the office.
Yeah, in the office. It's scary. It's scary.
There's an old saying in poetry that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and that would include novelists. And what it means is, if the writer can get you to think and feel, then your actions will follow. And so a novelist like Octavia Butler, getting you to think and feel about these things, is doing the work that precedes politics, I think. She's sort of preparing the mind and the heart for action by getting you to think it through and experience it through. And then when reality catches up to her forecasts, you might be prepared for it in some inward way. Anyway, that's a theory.
That's a good theory. That's a good theory. So, David, I just wanted to mention a couple of, one of the reasons I really loved your book was that such interesting use of language. It's beautifully written, I guess, is what I want to say. So I just want to read a couple of things that I marked.
I'd be honored.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So this is, I'm not even quite sure what the context was, but you wrote, "Sometimes I feel like a pomegranate so full of these translucent moments that they might spill out if I am bumped too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go back to my normal rough-skinned self."
But I remember, I think about what I have within me, what has been given, that abundance.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you for picking that. That's just one of the, you know, you find yourself coming up to these brief moments in writing where everything seems to pull together into what looks like a crystal. And I definitely think that's one for this book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And,
I wanted to continue it with those other two sentences that I just did, because it ends with the word abundance, which is a useful word. I think I realize it's a bit of a buzzword sometimes. People talk about abundance thinking, but, you know, there's a lot of truth to it. And when you reckon with what this created or uncreated world of reality gives us, you know, air to breathe and water to drink and beauty to drink in, it's really hard to maintain your sort of petty, pissy mentality. And you're invited instead to go to this sort of abundance place where you might actually be able to be a little bit more generous to the other humans too when you're working from that place. So I guess that's some of the magical richness that this world gives us if we remember to just stop and experience it. It's such a simple principle and so hard to practice. So anyway, thank you for finding that.
You're welcome. And here's another one where you're talking about one of the organ pieces in St. Eustache. Is that how you pronounce it?
That is so exactly right.
It ends and there's a pause for the last chord to finish its journey and leave us in a sort of high-calorie silence. Silence embodying everything, carved from nothing. It's an odd, destabilizing feeling, that long beat of after. That really does capture that moment.
Yeah, thank you. It's hard to put it into words. But it opens your mind up for all of these other possibilities. And it's possible to make fun of church going. You know, it's had so many satirical novels written about hypocritical Puritan people with nice suits on and pinched faces. But the practice of going somewhere where you can be opened up and taken out of your daily struggle mind, boy, it's hard to beat. You know, whether it's church or temple or riverside meditation under a big grove of trees, it's really, really important to have some place to go to get into that larger self.
And then this is just a really kind of an odd thing that that took me back to something I had forgotten about and a feeling that I had forgotten about. Let's see. You're looking at one of the Vermeer paintings, Milkmaid. You say, I had decided not to advertise my emotions, just let the thing be. Tears, though, were under my eyelids, and a sense of the indwelling mystery of everything I had ever loved, the far peaks I had climbed to get pure light and solitude. And here's the line that took me back. The way I had toiled in my library carrel all those years to find something knowable and true. I had forgotten about library carrels and how much I loved being in a library with going to the stack and bringing back a stack of books to the carrel and researching and digging through. Because you know what? I don't do that anymore because of the internet.
We are prevented from going to those libraries. You know, not everybody gets to go to a university library, but for those who don't recognize the word, it's like a little desk with its own little surround on three sides, but open on the fourth side.
Yeah.
And if you're a graduate student, you might have one assigned to you. And there you can stack your books and spend your mornings and afternoons and night times too, toiling away. I used to close the library at Emory University where I did my graduate work. I used to close that library six nights a week.
Oh, wow.
Right up to 11 o'clock. I'm an earnest kid. You know, when you're raised Baptist, you're taught to be earnest about everything. And I may not be a Baptist anymore, but...
but you're still earnest.
I'm still earnest and, oh, maybe evangelizing for the sublime now. I don't know.
Wow. So I wanted to ask you about another thing that was in your bio that I didn't mention it up front. It says you teach the Wild Writers seminars. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yep. I meet with experienced writers. I pick 8 or 10 of them, and we meet for 11 weeks, 3 hours on a Sunday afternoon. And it's in some ways a typical writer's workshop. The one that's running right now is focused on the memoir. I'm calling it the nonlinear memoir, and I guess my book is an example of that. It's where you use the materials of your life and you speak in the first person, but instead of trying to take your reader on a kind of slog from, well, I was born here, and then I was raised this way, and these were my parents, and then I went to school, you know, that chronology. Instead of using that, we look for what it is going on in our life that a lot of these events turn out to be about, so that the writing is about something bigger than yourself. Mountains of Paris is my memoir, for sure. It's about me and my experiences, but it's organized in a way that says, and what's findable in those experiences and what's interesting is not me, but what I experienced in the presence of nature and great creativity. And so it allows me to relax some of the sort of self-involvement and egotism of writing a memoir and stand with myself in my own experiences, but looking at something bigger and more worthy and more way more interesting than me. Each one of these students has, of course, his or her own life, and we get to struggle with what it means to write from your life and how you handle the hurt and difficulty of your life without letting it overtake you, or without sounding victim-y or whiny or self-pitying, things that will turn a reader away instantaneously. Yeah. And one of the great things about a writing workshop like this is that you have an immediate audience. You have 8 or 10 people who will be your audience for the next week's work, and you can bring it to the group, and if it's your turn, you get to read it out and get friendly crit from everybody. People will say, well, this works for me, and I'm puzzled by this. And you get that kind of feedback. Nothing like an audience to pull the writing out of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
we are more than halfway through the current 11-week run, and boy, am I having a good time teaching it.
So this is in Portland?
It is, yeah.
So you have to be in Portland to participate.
Yeah, kind of do. I do.
And it also says here that you're founder and general editor of Kelsen Books.
Yes.
What exactly is that?
It's a small press in Portland, and we do books by writers who have something to say about the natural world and who bring a sort of fierce, generous creativity to their work. Mm-hmm. So right now, for instance, I have just published a new book by David Beispiel, who's a very well-known poet. And it's a book of creativity about writing. It's called Every Writer Has a Thousand Faces. This book has been out for 10 years, and we have produced a 10th anniversary edition and revised it, and we have a foreword by Chuck Palahniuk, the author of Fight Club. And boy, this is a beautiful little book. We take some pains to make good-looking books. So that's an example of a new book that's out on the market really in the next month, for writers and creative people of all sorts, because it's about creative process and how that works, and some advice and a tricky way to handle it. His angle is, don't invest too much in your first draft. In fact, don't even think of it as a draft. Think of it as a way to fail gloriously and figure out how to take what works and move it forward into the next draft, the next version, and the next version after that. So it's about kind of letting go and seeing that the process is heading somewhere, and if you freeze it at a given state too early, then you've prevented it from moving. So keep it fluid and see where it goes. Oh, it's such good, smart advice, and he's such a good writer. I'm a fan of this book. Every Writer Has a Thousand Faces. That's the name. There, I got to publicize my book.
And I'm looking at your website, and you say, we are a small press. We seek projects we strongly believe in and which we can fully support. And then it says, we're highly selective. Do not send us your manuscript.
Thank you. Yes, I don't mind being queried. So send me an email with a query, and we'll take it from there. But, you know, most of the time it's just me, and I don't want to have my whole creative life absorbed in reading manuscripts and sending people responses. It's just I want to keep writing as well as publishing. So I'm being pretty careful about how to manage what comes in. But boy, do I want the next good manuscript, you know?
Why did you decide to start a small press?
Well, it started off in vanity.
Ah.
The year was 2009, actually 2008, and Bush number two was getting ready to leave office. And I had been writing short essays during the whole eight-year ordeal of warfare and lying. It's hard to remember now how upsetting it was to have a vice president who was seemingly a loose cannon and a president who didn't seem to care about factuality. And, it's grown to a bigger problem now.
Yeah,
but at
much.
The time, it was maddening and crazy-making, and we were at war and killing people.
Yeah.
So I had a whole suite of essays that I'd been writing in response to that, and I was not having success at finding a publisher, so I just self-published the thing. It's called What We Love Will Save Us.
And I see that on the website,
yep,
too.
And it was to get that book out the door, and I learned about publishing and print on demand and went through all the stages. And once I had done that, I thought, well, I should use what I've learned and bring some other good books into the world. And so we've been finding the select nonfiction books that the world needs and bringing them out.
Now, The Mountains of Paris is published by the Oregon State University Press. Have you worked with them for more than one of your books?
Yeah, they have done three other books, so we're up to four books now with them.
Wow.
All the way back to my very first book in 1989, which was called Earth Rising.
So interesting that they weren't willing to go with the one that caused you to...
Well, that's the writer's life. You knock on a lot of doors and you collect a lot of rejections. They didn't see it, but you know that the title essay, What We Love Will Save Us, was originally published in High Country News, sorry. And I still get responses to it. It was published originally in 2003, and even now people run across it and they're sort of moved and they send me a note. It's the darndest thing.
Wow. So now you're on the other side of the rejection letter. Sometimes.
Yes, and it reminds me to be as kind as possible. But I've been an English teacher for many decades, and so I've learned that first duty is to tell the truth. Mm. First duty is to tell the truth, and then bring as much kindness and humanity to that as possible. But it does nobody any good to pretend. And this was true of my writing students in college classes. They didn't need me to be their mom and pretend everything they did was great. They needed me to tell them the truth. This is working. This is not. So I had some experience that helped prepare me for how to handle writers who are eager for a big fat yes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they need from me is reality. And so I give them that as sweetly and kindly as possible. And then, of course, comes the amazing manuscript. And then I'm the one who has to say thank you and feel the effect of someone else's beauty and skill and generosity. So it works both ways.
Now, you mentioned that The Mountains of Paris is an example of a nonlinear memoir.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm curious about is how... I'm guessing you didn't write it in the same order that it ended up in, that the various essays were.
It's true. Yes. Yeah.
So how did you put it together?
Well, have you ever been involved with hanging an art show?
Not directly. No, but I can
you know,
imagine.
So picture a big gallery space, a big one, and you've got, let's say, 50 paintings that you've done over the past 3 years. Where do they go? And which one reflects or in some ways has an interesting relationship to the one to its left and the one to its right? And it's a question of pace and color and size and impact and emotion, right?
Right.
There's so many variables that it's maddening, and you can spend a long time with the, there are 25 chapters in the Mountains of Paris. You print them all out, staple them individually, and then you throw them on the big bed and start moving them around. Although I actually have a composition table that's 12 feet long and 18 inches wide. It's like a big, big plank.
Okay, but did you at least know what was going to be first and what was going to be last?
No.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I had an introductory chapter in which I talked about what I was going to talk about, and it was smart and correct, and I was glad, I was proud of the language in it, but it needed something more gripping, and so instead I tore it out, put it in a file somewhere, and wrote this narrative version that has some person having an experience in the real world. And I think it's a storytelling beginning instead of a thinky beginning. And I think that reaches people much more immediately. So that part didn't even exist until way late in the process.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a fun... the struggle to organize it. You know, there are three, the other organizing principle that I did see from the start was that there are three chapters about St. Eustache.
Yes.
And it's the beginning chapter, the middle chapter, and the end chapter. And in the first chapter, the first approach, I talk about the space, the spaciousness and the feeling that space gives you. In the middle chapter, I talk about music, which is the reason, what brought me there. And in the last chapter, I talk about human solidarity, about the spiritual world and solidarity with the other humans, because I noticed that they had a really vigorous social works program going on. They fed 300 people on the church portico every single night of the winter. 300 people they fed soup to.
Wow.
And I started thinking about that and asking, what is the connection between the sublime and this solidarity? Is it just an accidental, chancy thing that the place I go for the sublime also is practicing this connectedness and generosity and solidarity with the humans? And I came to think that it's not an accident, that the two things are related. And then I dug deeper, and I found actual sociological psych research from serious researchers published in research journals, where they actually test the connection between the experience of awe and wonder and the feeling of social connectedness. And what they found was, for instance, a guy at the Wharton School in Pennsylvania tested what goes viral on the internet fastest? Of course, anger does.
Mm-hmm.
The only emotion that can equal it is the emotion of awe and wonder.
Mm.
It's the only one. So if you send out some posting that has something really beautiful and awe-inspiring in it, that will have as much penetration and sharing as some angry little political thing that stokes your emotion of rage. Those, the only alternative to the rage that we're experiencing right now and the division of it is for us to take the medicine that counteracts it, and that is anchoring ourselves in awe and wonder.
Okay, that is the perfect thing to close on.
Oh, good.
Because we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today, David.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Monica. I really appreciate it.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye. Bye.